I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. Yesterday, President Trump reminded us that he was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris. Parisians are relieved, but others are stunned by what is seen by many as a dramatic abnegation of leadership on climate change. In withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, Trump kept his oft-stated campaign promise, but the announcement comes in the wake of a frosty reception at the G7 summit last week. Hovering over all of this, an expanding probe into connections between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives. We'll talk about the week's news with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. And we'll begin today with a conversation about the fate of the paid sick leave bill that Governor Hogan has vetoed. The bill's sponsor, Delegate Luke Klippinger and Michael O'Halloran, the Maryland State Director of the National Federation of Small Businesses, join me on the Midday News Wrap right after these headlines. Welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Coming up a little later in today's show, a conversation with Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. We'll talk about another very busy week in Washington, but we'll begin today with a conversation about a bill to require employers at businesses with 15 or more full-time employees to earn at least 5 paid sick days a year. The bill was sponsored by Luke Klippinger, who, along with Robin Lewis and Brooke Learman, represents Baltimore City in the Maryland House of Delegates. The bill passed in late April, and last week, Governor Larry Hogan vetoed it. Delegate Luke Klippinger joins us on the phone today from Frederick, where he's attending a meeting. Delegate, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon.
And we had hoped to be joined this afternoon by Michael O'Halloran as well. He is the Maryland State Director of the National Federation of Small Businesses. They oppose this legislation. Mr. O'Halloran called just a few minutes ago to say that a family emergency is preventing him from joining us. So we certainly hope that that emergency gets taken care of. But Delegate, tell us what's in your bill, what the purpose of it is.
The House Bill 1 would provide 5 days of earned sick leave to Marylanders, about 700,000 Marylanders. They would be paid sick days if the employee worked at a business with 15 or more employees. They would be unpaid if it was under 15 employees. It's legislation that we have worked on for the last 5 years in the General Assembly, bringing together lots of different organizations and businesses from across the state and hearing a lot of concerns and questions and trying to address those concerns along the way. And I think we've got a great product that, frankly, I was very disappointed that the governor vetoed. But I think that we will be able to override his veto in January.
And the governor himself had proposed legislation around paid sick leave. What is different between his proposal and yours? His did not make it to see the light of day, and yours, as you said, after several years of trying, has passed. What are the salient differences between the two pieces of legislation? Because obviously he's thinking that he's going to veto this bill and try to return to something closer to his proposal.
Well, the big thing with earned sick days and the importance of earned sick days comes down to helping those people who really need the help the most, in that when people have to choose between their jobs and getting better, it creates not just a stress on themselves and their families, it can dramatically impact their quality of life or, in fact, their ability to pay for their rent, their ability to pay for their water bill, and it forces their families to face challenges that they should simply not have to face. So one of the groups of people that is targeted by the bill that passed, as opposed to the governor's bill, are people who are working multiple part-time jobs. They're working jobs in restaurants. They're working jobs in healthcare facilities. And they have to keep those jobs just to be able to get by. So when they get sick, it's a major problem. It's a major problem for their bottom line. It's a major problem for keeping the lights on. The governor's bill would have ensured that people who worked at businesses with 50 or more employees would have been covered with earned sick leave. And the reality, as Delegate Shalaga, the Republican whip in the House, pointed out, that she didn't know of very many of any businesses with 50 or more employees that didn't already provide sick leave to people. So the biggest difference is the governor's bill basically gave sick leave to people who already had sick leave. House Bill 1 and the bill that we've worked on so hard and so long over the last 5 years really does expand the playing field and get sick leave to the people for whom it can mean the difference between being able to pay your rent or not.
And the governor's bill, again, as you've just mentioned, one of the big distinctions is he was looking to cover businesses that have 50 or more employees. Your bill...
At one location.
At one location. So if you own a chain of McDonald's stores and you employ 30
correct.
People at six different stores...
Not covered.
Yours is 15, but there are small business owners who say that that's a burden, that that's really going to impact how many they hire, who they hire, and how frequently they hire.
So this is now, we would be the eighth state to put an earned sick leave policy on the books if we override, when we override the governor's veto. There's a total of 39 jurisdictions, seven other states. And in the other states that have passed this legislation, the concerns were expressed over and over again that small businesses wouldn't be able to handle it, that it was going to hurt them and cause them to close. And the reality is that's not what's happened across the country when these statutes have come on the books. In Connecticut, the vast majority of employers didn't have to raise prices, didn't fire employees, didn't cut wages after a sick leave bill was passed there. In Washington, D.C., they've actually passed sick leave legislation two times. And a study showed that it didn't dissuade people from citing their businesses in Washington, nor did it encourage businesses to leave. In Washington state, 70% of the businesses said that it didn't impact their business in any substantial way. So the facts, once these bills have become law, once the evidence is out there, once people get to see what it's like, what they discover is that this legislation helps small businesses to cut down on turnover. And that's one of the big advantages that we've got with this legislation, in that whenever you have to replace somebody, and if you have to replace them because they had to leave the job, because they missed a day of work, because they were ill, it costs the business about 20% of that person's salary to be able to retrain the next person. When you cut down on turnover, you help the businesses prosper. When you don't transmit diseases at the workplace, it means that you've got a more productive workplace because people are able to take care of themselves. So really, at the end of the day, the impact of this legislation has been very positive across the country. It helps with public health. It helps with business, and we think it'll help business here in Maryland.
Folks have said that this would cover about 700,000 people in Maryland. Is that a number you're comfortable with, and where does that number come from?
So it comes from, I believe it's an amalgamation of numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It would be about 450,000 people who have paid sick leave, that they would get paid sick leave. So that would be the people who are working at businesses with 15 or more employees. And it would be about 250,000 people who would receive unpaid leave because they're in a business that was smaller than that.
I don't know if you had a chance to see an article in the New York Times, a study about Walmart. And they interviewed, surveyed about 1,000 employees for Walmart, finding that in many cases, the individual managers of the Walmarts in which these people worked were not accepting notes from doctors as excuses for being out of work, and had problems being compensated or sometimes even retained as employees because of being ill and not reporting for work. Have you seen that piece? I mean, and does obviously an employer like Walmart employs a whole lot more than 50 people in any given location even. But is that the kind of thing that prompts you to think that this needs to be dictated and mandated by the state as opposed to letting the marketplace take care of itself? I mean, if you're saying that, you know, the costs of replacing employees and the health impacts of employees who are coming to work sick, these would all be things that I think people in small businesses might point to as incentives for them to take care of this without legislation.
And there are businesses that do provide sick leave to their employees. And for what it's worth, we include language in the bill that says that if you already have a sick leave policy or you have a policy that provides 5 days of leave to people who work there that they can take for any reason, then that's fine. Then they don't have to do anything more. But I think, again, the importance here comes back to the people who are the most impacted. The big chunk of that 700,000 people are people who work at restaurants, people who work at retailers, people who work in hospitals, people who work with people every day who they themselves can be, you know, spreading diseases when they come to work ill. These are the groups of people that we really do want to target, and it is a public health concern as much as it is a business concern, as much as it is a family well-being concern.
We just got a couple minutes left, but I want to go to the phones. Karen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Delegate Luke Klippinger. You're a nurse, as I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. And I was scheduled to work Wednesday night and Thursday night. I worked at Hopkins, and I was out walking, and I tripped, and I busted. Thank God I didn't break anything, but I fell on my right side because I'm right-handed. And I kind of lurched that way, and my arm was pretty banged up, and it's getting better. But, you know, I called out sick, and I got paid for my two shifts. I couldn't work, and I would not have been of any use if I'd gone in, because just today is the first day I'm kind of my arm is getting back to normal. But I thought about how fortunate I am that I have paid sick leave, and I don't live anywhere near, you know, I have, you know, I'm very comfortably, you know, set and everything. But I thought about the people who really, sounds like my coworkers, the nursing assistants and maybe some nurses also, but I was saying more the people with lower wages, how they live so close to the margin. And the whole idea that they would probably try to come into work and lift and turn patients with a busted up arm, and that wouldn't work out well for anybody. But I also know that one of the things about working for a larger business or for a business that provides is I think it does help recruitment and retention. If you treat people well, I really think they're going to stay with you longer, and they'll overlook certain things about the job that they don't like.
I'll tell you, this is something that, the story that I've told is we've gone through the legislative debate this year. Just about a year ago, I was diagnosed with a very rare form of leukemia. I was suddenly found myself at the University of Maryland Cancer Center, and I genuinely didn't know what was going on. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I was suffering from significant fatigue at the time, and they told me I had leukemia. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that time to take off. And I get that time off because in my day job, I'm a state's attorney in Anne Arundel County. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have sick leave, and I was incredibly fortunate to be able to take that time off. And as far as I see it, you know, if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for 700,000 Marylanders who need the help.
Well, Karen, thank you for your call. And Delegate, thank you for your time. And we should say once again that you are confident that the legislature will override this veto. And speaking of sick, we found out today that Speaker Mike Bush was operated on and had a liver transplant, and he is on record as saying that this would be a priority for him when the legislature reconvenes in January. But you're confident that this veto will be overridden?
First of all, the Speaker, we call him Iron Mike, and he's going to come back stronger than ever, and our prayers are with him and his family right now. I feel confident, but I am never overconfident when it comes to predicting a vote in the legislature. So we'll work really hard, and we'll make sure we get the majority.
Delegate Luke Klippinger represents the 46th District, that's Baltimore City, in the Maryland House of Delegates. WIPR's State House reporter Rachel Bay will, of course, keep us informed on the fate of House Bill 1, the Maryland Healthy Working Families Act, as this process plays out. Delegate, thank you for your time. Have a good weekend. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
And by the way, we're delighted to hear that you're feeling better as well.
I'm in remission, and that's because of the good people of the University of Maryland.
All right, God bless. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after a quick break, the Midday News Wrap continues with Tamara Keith of NPR friend Will England of the Washington Post. We'll talk about the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords, as well as some of the other big stories of the week. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, a conversation about one of the most enigmatic figures in the world of entertainment. In a new biography, David Letterman is called the last great giant of late night. I'll talk to the author who has chronicled Letterman's career in his new book. That's coming up Midday on Monday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Tamara Keith joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. She covers the White House for NPR and co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Tam, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on the show. Thank you.
And here with me in Studio A is Will England. He is a foreign assignment editor at the Washington Post. He directs that paper's Russia coverage. His latest book is about Russia. It's called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Will, welcome back, sir. Good to see you.
Thanks very much.
So, Tamara Keith, the Wall Street Journal headline today about the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Accord is less than meets the eye. There are people who support the president's decision who say this is really no big deal. Things will go on sort of status pro ante anyway. It's not going to have that big an effect. What do you think the general feeling in political Washington is on the morning after this big announcement?
Well, I think the general feeling of political Washington is depends on which side of the aisle you're on, though not exactly that. There are people who absolutely support the president's decision, including the Speaker of the House and obviously the EPA director and many people in the Trump orbit and many Republicans in Congress. But surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, there are a number of Republicans in Congress who are sort of either more moderate or in seats that are, you know, would be considered at risk in the next election, or are from areas where the environment is sort of a top of mind issue for folks, who have said that they believe that the president made a mistake, which is surprising that it didn't fall precisely on partisan lines the way sometimes these things do, or often these things do. And then, of course, you're hearing from business leaders, many of whom are actually Republicans, who wanted the president to stay in. Now, the reality is that the Paris Climate Accord is voluntary, that the commitments that the United States made were voluntary, that the United States, had the president decided he wanted to stay in, he could have just simply said, we have new goals and we'll go for those different new goals. So the actual functional change in terms of U.S. climate policy is maybe not massive, but it's more, the argument against it is about, you know, the U.S. having a seat at the table, the U.S. Having a role as a leader of the free world, if you will.
And Will England, I mean, to Tam's point, I mean, have we lost our seat at the table? I mean, you've had several stints as a Moscow correspondent. You're covering, you know, foreign assignments at the Washington Post. What does this do to our capacity to affect things on the world stage, even outside the realm of climate, for example?
Well, on the one hand, you had Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, saying even before the announcement that Germany and Europe is going to have to rely on itself from now on. Hope to maintain friendly relations with the United States, but can no longer depend on the United States. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, delivered a somewhat blistering attack on Trump late last night in French time.
And finished his statement in English,
yes,
saying, make the planet great again.
Yes.
Hey,
yes.
He was going directly at the president, wasn't he?
He was. So we're certainly losing goodwill in Europe, I would put it that way. I think a very interesting other chapter in this is you have China and India who have both signed on to the Paris Accord. The Chinese have been quite genuine about their desire to address global warming. When India joined in, there was a lot of feeling that maybe this wasn't terribly sincere. India is the second biggest polluter in Asia after China. But now Narendra Modi, the prime minister, has been trying to step up to the plate. And will China and India take the initiative to try to become leaders, at least on this global warming issue in the years ahead, take leadership away from the United States? It would be very difficult for them to do that in some ways, because they don't have the resources the U.S. does. But they want to be players.
And Tamkeith, I mean, is this in fact much more of a domestic political play by the president than it is an international play? I mean, he had said all through the campaign he thought climate change was a hoax and he was going to get out of this terrible bum deal. I mean, he went to great pains yesterday reminding everybody that he was elected to represent Pittsburgh instead of Paris, although, as I understand it, Secretary Clinton got about 80% of the vote in Pittsburgh. But, I mean, what does this do for him as a domestic political move?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of like the inside game and the outside game. And in reality, among a certain subset of American voters, the idea of Emmanuel Macron being upset at the president of the United States is probably a good thing. And those are the voters that President Trump is appealing to. He you know, ever since becoming president, he has really focused on his base and holding on to his base and making his base happy. And he has done almost nothing to try to appeal to people who either voted for Hillary Clinton or reluctantly voted for him. He has been sort of single-mindedly focused on, you know, as he would say, the forgotten men and women, the people who are the core of his base. And this was clearly a play for those voters. This was another example of, you know, he talked a lot about jobs and prioritizing jobs. And in fact, his speech included a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with the climate agreement or with climate change, and just included a lot of, hey, I'm on TV kind of stuff. I might as well talk about all these jobs that I'm creating, though today's jobs report was below expectations.
Tamkeith is not on TV. She is on the radio here on the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Will England is with us here in the studio. 410-662-8780 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address to follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. So, Will England, Tamkeith makes a great point in that this is something that, you know, this is red meat to the supporters. I'm fascinated by the fact that it seems that Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, and I spoke to John Allen and Amy Parnes, who wrote a devastating critique of her campaign, a book called Shattered, Inside the Doomed Campaign of Hillary Clinton, so you understood where they were coming from just by reading the cover. She also, in her campaign, made a decision not really to try to persuade Trump voters to vote for her. She just sort of gave up on them, I think, kind of early on in the process and had a strategy that said, we're going to go with the people who are already with us. Trump is not trying to persuade any people who supported Secretary Clinton now. I mean, are we at a point in American politics where nobody's even trying to win the argument anymore?
That's one way of putting it, I think. There was an argument, an article just the other day about how under Trump, the polarization of America has become even more pronounced than it had been, which is somewhat difficult to believe, considering where we were a year ago.
It's a pretty incredibly low bar.
It is. The economic segregation in the U.S., the party segregation as well has grown and grown and grown. I think there are plenty of people on the left side, the liberal side, who are thinking to themselves, we've got to find ways to reach out to these people. You know, the sort of the Bernie Sanders types within the Democratic Party. They're concerned about Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. The Hillary Clinton wing, I mean, they would say they are, of course, but the Democratic Party has done very little really to try to reach out to the people who voted for Trump. And I would say that of course, the Republican Party is in considerable turmoil at the moment. And one thing they're not thinking about is reaching out to Democrats on the coasts.
And Tam, of course, hovering over all of this is the expanding investigation into Russian connections between members of the Trump campaign during the presidential campaign. I wonder, is it part of the president's calculation that he's really going to need the base moving forward in these next few weeks and months with Robert Mueller, the former director of the FBI, leading an intense investigation? We've got James Comey going to be giving what a lot of people think is going to be pretty explosive testimony next Thursday in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Is he trying to circle the wagons and make sure that those are for him, are with him and on board here at this particular moment?
I don't know if those two things are directly related. It's possible that that's part of the calculation, but I think more likely it is simply that the President Trump wants to make these people happy. He wants to keep the promises that he can keep. And, you know, there are a lot of promises that he hasn't kept or hasn't been able to keep. You know, the wall is not currently being built on the Mexico border, and it is not being paid for by Mexico. His budget calls for about 74 miles worth of wall, which is not the distance of the entire U.S.-Mexico border. So there are a lot of things where he hasn't been able to yet keep the promises, where he has run into roadblocks that every president has run into, also known as Congress, and the way our system is designed and created. And so in the areas where he has the ability to act on his own, he has been doing that. Those areas include things like immigration enforcement, though not the travel ban, which we'll get to, I'm sure, later. Things like immigration enforcement and also these sort of international agreements. If you might remember, he pulled out of TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, very early in his presidency. And Paris and pulling out of Paris is in line with that. He has been consistent throughout his candidacy. One of the things he's been most consistent on as president and as a candidate was his absolute distaste for sort of global or large multilateral agreements.
And Will England, on Sunday on Meet the Press, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal named Kim Strassel repeated a claim that had been made in Breitbart and some other right-leaning publications that when it comes to back channels and Jared Kushner's evidently efforts to establish a back channel with the Russians before Mr. Trump took office and have these back channels even placed in Russian facilities out of earshot and eyeshot of American intelligence. Of course, your paper broke this very explosive story just a few days ago. Kim Strassel from the Wall Street Journal made the claim that President Obama himself in 2008 had sent an aide, William Miller, to Iran to establish a similar back channel in Iran. The Daily Beast is swatting that back, saying that that's fake news, that that didn't happen. Mr. Miller has denied it. Ben Rhodes, another aide to President Obama, has denied it. What can you tell us about the Obama incident and whether or not there is, in fact, any equivalency between what Jared Kushner is doing and what President Obama is being accused of having done back in 2008?
Well, let me just go back further in time just for a moment and remind the listeners that Richard Nixon had a back channel with the government in South Vietnam in 1968 when he was running for president, which some people would argue had very deleterious consequences for the continuation of the war. What Obama is accused of doing was setting up a diplomatic back channel, not presumably using Iranian security apparatus to facilitate the communication. I think that's the really big difference. If what we've reported in the Post, that Jared Kushner proposed using essentially Russian spy gear, Russian encrypted communications gear to communicate with people in the Kremlin. That's really very different. Now, on another point, we had a very interesting story in the Post this morning that he met with the head of the of a Russian export bank, Vnesh Ekonom Bank, in December 2016. And to this day, the bank is saying that was about business deals, and the White House is saying it was about diplomacy. Their stories aren't meshing. And this is, to my mind, very peculiar.
Tam Keith, what are people saying about that in the White House? And what's the mood when it comes to, you know, this upcoming Comey testimony and just the what appears to be an intensifying scrutiny about connections between the Trump campaign and Russia?
Well, the good news for the White House this week is they finally have an answer. Please consult outside counsel.
Yeah.
The White House has sort of begun the process of setting up what you might call a war room or basically compartmentalizing and just walling off all the Russia stuff from the rest of their agenda. It's not clear that that's really going to work. And there, you know, there's a certain level of concern within the ranks of people who are working in the White House because, you know, if you look back at history, basically everyone in the Clinton administration ended up having to have their own lawyer, and it wasn't cheap.
Let's try to sneak in a couple of phone calls before we go to a break. Lorenzo in Baltimore, you're on the Midday News Wrap with Tam Keith and Will England.
Good afternoon to you.
Hi, what's on your mind?
So I've got 2 points. First of all, there's an argument going around from the right or I guess people who are supporting Trump's pulling out of this accord that it's ridiculous for government to subsidize, you know, green jobs or the green sector because the fact that the government subsidizes it means that it's not viable. And if it was viable, then businesses would do it instead of government. And it's a ridiculous argument because businesses invest in things that are short-term. Government always invests in long-term items. There's a lot of things we wouldn't have in this country if the government didn't think long-term about it. So it's a ridiculous argument, and I hope there's some folks get out there and smack it down. The second point is the farcical nature of Trump's speech yesterday. I mean, this little section that you led in with about, you know, I speak for Pittsburgh instead of Paris, you know, basically it makes it seem like he thought the whole agreement was about Paris. He didn't even understand what was in the agreement. That's what I thought of it. So I'd like to get your opinion off the air. Also, I want to give my sympathy to Tamara there because she has the duty of talking about the psychology of the White House. I don't know how you do that. Who could understand that? So, but anyway, have a great day.
But you do.
Thank you for your support.
You do it valiantly. That's right. On behalf of a grateful nation, Tamara Keith. But Will England, I mean, this perhaps is there were things that the president said in his statement that once again do not hold up to scrutiny in terms of his understanding of what the agreement requires. I mean, he used the phrase that he didn't want the United States to be tied up and bound down by foreign countries when in fact there's really no, you know, dimensions of this agreement that does anything like that. And there's a lot of information to suggest that it's not a job-killing thing, that that China is doing much better than he's giving China credit for doing. And, in fact, the United States has already reduced its carbon emissions. But is this kind of just a continuation of this very unusual, historically unusual, political populism coming from the Republican Party, which never used to be the party of the populace?
I think that is a way of looking at it. Yes, I mean, he also was talking about, you know, India getting billions and billions and billions, as he put it, of dollars out of the Paris Agreement, and no one has any idea what that is a reference to. We had another very interesting story in the Post today about reconstructing how this decision came about. And it seemed that the more he was pressed, and particularly the more he was pressed by European leaders when he was there for the G7 meeting on the this climate pact, the more he wanted to get out of it. So it's kind of like he got his back up in a way. And I think, you know, very consciously aware that getting his backup plays very well with this crowd here in the U.S.
Okay, we got to take a break. That's Will England. He is the foreign assignment editor for the Washington Post. He's done three tours as a Moscow correspondent for both the Baltimore Sun and the Washington Post. He's the author of March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Tamara Keith joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. She covers politics for NPR and co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. We'll have more on the news wrap when we return. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. We're going to go out now with a little music by the Allman Brothers Band. Greg Allman died last Sunday at the age of 69. Well, I've got to run to keep from hell, and I'm bound to keep on red. I've got one more silver dollar, but I'm not going to let them catch me, no. Not going to let them catch the midnight rider.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough. And we got a long way to go, you know, for us as a society and for us as African Americans until we feel equal in America.
Basketball superstar LeBron James speaking earlier this week. A home that he owns in Los Angeles was vandalized with racist slurs. He and the Cleveland Cavaliers are facing off against the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals, which began last night. Golden State won that game handily, and the next game is Sunday. With the attack and stabbing death of two passengers on a Portland light rail train last weekend, a noose found at the National African American History Museum, the death of ROTC student Richard Collins on the campus of the University of Maryland, and other incidents around the country, racial animus and hate crimes certainly appear to be on the rise. So is President Trump doing enough as the country's leader to condemn the people committing these acts, or as some have suggested, has his campaign and now his presidency given greater license to bigotry and intolerance? You're welcome to join our conversation and let us know what you think. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. It's the Midday News Wrap. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, and Will England, the foreign assignment editor at the Washington Post, joins me here in Studio A. So, Tam, we have an email from Jane who writes, am I the only one bothered by the ethics waivers given by the Trump administration to his staff? Is it legal? In fact, the White House finally broke down after stalling for quite a bit of time, making public the fact that they had issued 14 waivers. What do those waivers entail? Who got them? And how important is this?
So to go back just another step, when he was running for president towards the end of the campaign, President Trump started talking a lot about draining the swamp. And part of that was that he was going to institute very tough ethics requirements on people in the executive branch. And so when he came into office, it actually took a bit longer than we thought it might. He kind of delayed a little bit, but ultimately signed an executive order requiring all executive branch appointees to sign these ethics agreements. Interestingly, the agreement language, the language of his executive order, had basically been cribbed off of President Obama and President Clinton. It was sort of a combination of actual copy-paste direct language from those two presidents' similar executive orders on ethics. There was within President Trump's executive order and also within both President Clinton and President Obama's executive order an out that said, you know, that there can be a waiver to these requirements, requirements that people not work on issues that they lobbied on recently that they couldn't get into lobbying or working in a foreign government for 5 years after leaving the administration. So, The President Obama had something like 17 waivers through the course of his entire 8-year presidency. President Trump has had, I believe it's 14 already. And one of the more notable ones, there's some people who were lobbyists who are now in the administration working on the very things that they lobbied on. Also, Steve Bannon got a waiver that basically allows him to continue communicating with Breitbart News, which is the organization that he left when he came into the administration.
Will England, what is this going to do in terms of the president's credibility and in terms of people's trust in general, in his capacity to make good on his promises? As Tam mentioned, several promises have already not been kept, the wall and, you know, accusing China of being a currency manipulator. And I mean, there's a long list of things that he's decided to back off of. Just this week, he decided to delay at least a decision about moving the embassy in Israel. How does this all fit in together?
I don't think we're going to see too much of a dent. I think a very large number of people in this country didn't give him much credibility to begin with, didn't believe what he was saying. And I think to his supporters, it's all, I think there are two factors. One of them is that the media outlets that they tend to patronize aren't really reporting this kind of thing. And if they are, they're blaming Congress or blaming the Democrats or blaming Hillary Clinton for getting in the way. And then moreover, there's this feeling of, well, I know he wasn't actually going to do this, but you know, I loved it the way that he talked about this.
Yeah, it's like drain the swamp with an asterisk. But you know, people aren't looking at the asterisks because drain the swamp, he just got the U.S. out of, you know, a climate agreement. He got these really big headlines. And so he's doing the big splashy things. And truth be told, ethics stuff, as much as it is a deep concern to a lot of people, it's not the kind of thing that is nearly as splashy as the president going out to the Rose Garden and saying he's pulling out of an international agreement.
And tweeting all the while, making...
And not about ethics.
Right, not about ethics, but also making pretty still frequent references to the campaign and the Democrats and stuff. And in this dizzying array of stories that we're once again trying to comprehend at week's end, it's been the same ever since he took office. One story that may get a little buried in the morass is Hillary Clinton and some remarks she made yesterday, I guess, about a variety of subjects, including when it comes to the blame game, including the Democratic National Committee.
I inherit nothing from the Democratic Party. I mean, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong.
So, Tam, I mean, the president certainly enjoys sort of relitigating the election as often as he can. I wonder, what do you make of Secretary Clinton's decision to, you know, leap back onto the public stage and keep talking about this? And I wonder if this isn't just, you know, grist for the mill in the Trump administration.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely her right to be on the public stage and say what she wants to say on the public stage. And people do keep asking her what she thought went wrong. I think there's some large body of thought that she should just apologize and admit she was a terrible candidate and move on. And I don't think that she agrees with that. And I think a lot of her supporters don't agree with that. Going after the DNC on data is sort of a fascinating turn because, you know, the Clinton campaign had been so loud and proud about how awesome they thought their data operation was. And they, you know, they basically, as is traditional on the Democratic side, at least, they went in to the DNC once she was the nominee and took over. And that's the way it has worked. That's the way it worked for Barack Obama. That's the way it worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And on the opposite side of it, Donald Trump had basically very little data operation. He had a skeleton of a campaign. He had virtually no campaign. But the RNC did have the data, and they didn't get credit for it. They weren't bragging about it in the way that the Clinton team was bragging about their data. And ultimately, the Clinton data operation fell short. And, you know, there were moments where I was out with her campaign where we would go to a campaign event in the middle of Florida or the middle of or even in Arizona, and you'd look at the crowd and you'd look at the number of protesters outside and you'd think, really? Your really smart data guys told you to go here?
Yeah, Robbie Mook, Mr. Analytics. Will England, Adrian sends us a tweet and says, while many view the president's actions as ill-advised, will this decision have a measurable impact on the voting in 2018 and 2020? So when it comes to the Paris Climate Accord decision in particular, do you think that's going to move the needle one way or the other?
Well, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about how polarized the country has become and how few people are prepared to change minds. I think as we see what develops out of this pullout, you know, people don't like dirty air, and the Paris Agreement, is aimed at you know, not getting sort of visible pollution out of the air, but at keeping the world from overheating. And yet, I think that there's kind of a default, you know, feeling that, well, clean is better than dirty. It could lead to some sort of movement. I'd be a little bit surprised if it did, but I think it could.
Let me just throw out a fun fact while we're on that topic, which is that although the president announced that he is pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement now, the way it was designed, countries can't actually begin pulling out until 3 years after the agreement was signed, and then it takes a full year. They have to give a year's notice, basically. So the way this is structured, the U.S. won't technically actually be able to pull out of Paris until right around Election Day 2020. Now, whether that makes it a campaign issue.
And if Mr. Trump isn't the president that's elected in 2020, could the new president come in and say, all right, deal's over, that decision's gone, we're staying in? Is that possible?
Well, I mean, then the new president can just get back in.
Yeah. Let's try to sneak in one phone call. Steve in Baltimore, welcome to the News Wrap. Thanks for your call.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind, sir?
I think that when you look at it as a Brit, which I am living in Maryland from the outside in, I don't have great knowledge of your political system in terms of your structure of government. But he seems to act, as in your President Trump, as a little bit of a dictator or a king in the way that he makes his decisions. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of collaboration that takes place in his decision-making process. And the other thing that I would say is that it's unfortunate, but all empires have their sunrise and sunset, and the UK lost its empire 70 years ago, and we had to go through a great deal of soul-searching on how to reinvigorate our industries. And over the last 50 years, we've changed very, very significantly. And I feel America needs to do the same thing. And going back to coal, which is a legacy technology, isn't the answer. It's almost backwards. So you should be looking forward with people like Elon Musk and the way that they think.
Well, Steve, you are not alone in that thought, and we are going to have to make that the last word today. We are out of time, but Will England, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
And Tam Keith in Washington, appreciate it very much. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Glad to be with you.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith also hosts the NPR Politics podcast. She's joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington in the middle of another very busy day after another very busy week. Will England has had three tours as a Moscow correspondent for both the Baltimore Sun and the Washington Post, where he now serves as that paper's foreign assignment editor. He's the author of March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. That'll do it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation about a new biography of David Letterman. Many contend that he inspired a generation of stand-up comedians and that he transformed the modern television talk show. I'll talk with New York Times comedy columnist Jason Zinnemann, the author of Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Thanks to the Marie-Louise Bistro for providing lunch today. They're located on Charles Street in Mount Vernon. They specialize in a blend of French, Italian, and Mediterranean cuisines. They're open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Menu and reservations at marielouisebistrocatering.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall, who is the male equivalent of Wonder Woman. Just saying. And the show is produced by Rob Civic. Bridget Armstrong and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Cogman from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate you listening today and every day. Look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.